Hey, hello to all 14 attendees, or 12 or without me, or 13 without me, or however many that is. I'm Hunt Tooley, and I'd like to welcome you to this course on the interwar years that we're beginning right now. This is, of course, the Ludwig von Mises Institute, and we are just about to start a six-week course. It has to do with the interwar period between World War I and II, and it has to do with the history of the world, and it has to do with the history of Austrian economics and some intertwining of those two. So it should be a lot of fun, really interesting, and I hope you get a lot out of it. We start with a session called The Bitter End of the First World War, and you've probably looked at the syllabus already. But before we actually begin and go through this roadmap a little and start to think about what the content of the course is going to be, I do want to say something about how we're doing it and what we will work toward each week and how we'll accomplish it. And so forth. First of all, this is how I conceive of the course as working. I conceive of us meeting together here Wednesdays on 5:30 Eastern time, and then I'll keep the sort of set lecture as close to an hour and 10 minutes. Many of you know me, and you know that I cheat a little in that regard. But then we'll shift into question and answer. So there's this formal part with the slides and all that, and then we just have a kind of question and answer. And in an ideal world, you would have read all of the stuff for assigned for today, the reading assignments for today by today. In other words, that would be the ideal. But on the other hand, it doesn't quite work like that for the first session. And to tell you the truth, I know that many of you are like me, busy lives, and you're doing this because you want to learn something, because you want to know more and all that. And with all the best will in the world, you might not be able to get to every bit of the reading. And I don't think that's any great sin. The readings are the ideal. It's clear from each of the sets of readings that there are some that are essential and some that are not. And one way that you'll know if they're essential is whether I kind of include those on the weekly reading essays, because that's another part of it. For each week that you listen to a lecture and do the readings, in other words, for each week of the course, then I will send out, I'll probably do this tomorrow, Candace Camray, who's the assistant for the course, is sitting there shaking his head and drinking his coffee and all that. But I'll probably send those out tomorrow, Cam, and the rest of you. And then you have a chance to sit down for a couple of days and think about it and answer the questions in essay form. A short essay form and address some of these issues. And in the essays, then you send it back to me. I read those essays and I give you a grade, like, you know, okay, or very good, or this really doesn't cut the mustard, or quite, you know, one of those official type grades. And the ones that are the ones that work are the ones that show obviously some effort, but also address the readings. So I mean, I assume you're going to listen to this lecture, but I would like you to do the reading as much as possible too. In a couple of cases, I include in the readings, well, you know, if you can't do this one, you can leave it out. And obviously that that goes, you know, in a larger sense for many other things. I would like you to read as much as possible, but I've really piled it on. It's about 200 pages a week on the average. And, you know, the things that I've written and assigned you to read, I think they're brief and concise and to the point, but said, you know, some of these other guys are so long-winded. So anyway, you'll just have to suffer through them and some way or skip a little or however you can do that. But that's the ideal. In other words, the course consists of this meeting and doing the reading. And then you think about that for a day or two. Then you write your essay and send it off to me. And then I grade it and get the grade back, and on we go. So that's the way I conceive of it working. For those of you who are watching this, not right now, but at a later time, it should work exactly the same way. There's a little bit of leeway here. Again, I know that people are busy, and sometimes people sign up for a course when they've got, I don't know, finals or something taking place during the first part, so they can't quite get to it. So they're a little bit behind on these weekly reading essays. And that's okay, too. I mean, this is, you know, it's, you're all not only volunteers but customers, so that's perfectly fine. We'll work in that framework with you. So that's not a big problem. So that's how I hope to approach it. And Kim may remind me of some other things I need to say in that regard. I do want to introduce both the two of the attendees tonight who are on here with us. One is Danny Sanchez, who operates the Mises Academy and is the ramrod of it and keeps us all in line and thunders down from on high when we make a misstep and all those things. And he's a great guy, and he's on here, and I'd like to thank him for great work that he does. Then also Cam Ray, who's my assistant, has been my assistant before, is a friend as well, and a good historian in his own right, and a good Austrian scholar. So we've got some high-powered folks sitting in tonight from the Mises Institute. But I'll also say that I haven't looked at who all the 14 or 12 of you are, but I do know that in this class, about a third of you, if I'm counting right, have been in my classes before, and some of you are distinguished in your own right as well. And I've read some of your material, and so I appreciate you being in the course, and I'm happy to have you with us. And I hope it's of value. Again, I hope it's of value to everybody. So let's look now at one more thing. I will try to keep track of questions during the lecture. And sometimes I just say something that I really didn't mean to say, or said it in a way that can't be understood by mere mortals. And if you find that to be the case, then try to get my attention by putting a comment on this on the Q&A line. I think, isn't that the best way to do it? We have a chat line and a Q&A, and or which is it, Kim? Is it best to go just on the chat line? Is that the easiest to follow? He'll answer in a second. Of course, there's a little delay here, and I'm thinking and looking at the notes and you know, and rolling on, so I don't always see comments, but I'll try. He says, Kim says chat or Q&A is fine. So I'll try to keep both of those open and glance down from time to time. But if I don't, we'll take care of it all in the question and answer, where I'll be looking right at the questions there. And that ought to work fine. Okay, well, enough for the preliminaries, and I think we should get started. Today, we end the war. And some of you have taken my World War I course, and some of you have had material that crisscrosses some of this material in either the inflation course or the totalitarian course or something. But my approach today is a little bit different, because everything we're going to do is a roadmap to get the war ended, but to understand how that worked kind of mechanically, and also some interior kinds of dynamics that produce this well, this terrible piece that that it produced. So what we're going to do today is talk a little bit about the nature of the of war, first of all. I want to deal specifically then with American intervention into the war in 1917. And then I want to think a bit about what I'm calling the inflation regime, you might call it the inflation paradigm. I want to think about that in terms of what that means as an internal dynamic of the war. The next thing I want to talk about is this really related issue, but separate in many ways, of international financial dealings during the war, and that part of the equation, very, very important. Then we want to go to the war itself, and we're going to talk a little bit about the not just strategy and general things, but a little bit about tactics and so forth, because that comes into the ending of the war in a very clear way. And then we will kind of sum up some statistics and think about what all this meant and what the cost of the war were, et cetera. And then I would like to end today's, today's class with a discussion of the organization of the peace. We want to get Woodrow Wilson on the George Washington sailing to Europe before we end today's class and start taking questions. So it's a big order. There's a lot in here, and if there are no objections, we will proceed and talk a little bit about the nature of World War One. And you know, I like this this photograph. I mean, this is one of the few live action photographs, relatively few live action photographs of World War One. Most of the great ones, you know, the over-the-top ones are proposed, I'm sorry to say. But this is a real live-action shot, we think, and fairly recently filmed. And it gives, I don't know, I love this, you know, you've heard the expression, the fog of war. And I think that fog was unusually dense in World War One in a metaphorical sense. And here it looks like the smoke and fog and all of it is quite a literal thing as well. But this tells us something, of course, about the nature of the war. First, I want to spend a moment or two about brutality and its preconditions. In my opinion, the 20th century is one of the most brutal, I guess the most brutal in the history of mankind. I mean, we don't know all about the history of mankind. We don't know what happened when groups of people encountered in kind of prehistoric times and the cave dwellers killed off the hunter, whatever. We don't know all that. So I don't think you can say conclusively, but in terms of recorded history, we've killed a lot more human beings in the last 100 years, 150 years, 120 years than in any other century. So it's an extraordinarily brutal century. And of course, World War One is an important part of that. So what part does it play? Well, as with so many issues that we deal with when we talk about World War One, and I'll repeat this over and over, you might get a little bit tired of it, hope not, but most of what the war produced was actually had to do with trends that were in train, that were already in progress before the war started. And indeed, in many cases, there's a kind of causal, I would say, confusion here, because some of the things that the war is supposed to have produced were also things that began that really helped start the war, like brutality. Here's this. European civilization reached a kind of high point in the 18th, or let's say the 19th century. In the liberal civilization that all classical liberals associated with peaceful exchange and a foreign policy that didn't hurt people and this type of thing. And there's that, it almost corresponds strangely with the international gold standard, that great old golden period when gold was the rule in Europe and the West and all the extensions of the West. Now, there's that kind of high point, and then less than a century later, it's all regenerated. Well, one thing that happened was that European empires expanded from the middle of the 19th century onward at a hugely rapid rate. Countries that hadn't been in the game before got into it. And I'm going to expand this outward and say it's not just going to Africa and doing the scramble for Africa. It's also, we're also talking here about killing off indigenous people where the empires had gone. And I'm talking about Australia. I'm talking about the United States. I'm talking about other places like that. So there are these colonial encounters that are all by nature not liberal. They are invasions, they're violent, and they led to violent measures. There was always some justification. We all know that. Every empire justifies itself in some way. You know, we're just going in, we just want to help, we just want the best for everybody. But one way or the other, these were all invasions. And so after the 1860s and the early 70s, when Italy and Germany had unified and these massive waves of nationalism sort of worked their way outward to expand national territory, technology helped Europeans go out. I mean, just the development, just the knowledge that if you put enough quinine into you, then you could stand some chance of surviving what is my disease? I'm blocking my disease. Somebody tell me. Greatest killer, malaria. Thank you. Just that knowledge helped conquer Africa. And in the process of all these conquests, and I include the United States in this too, just a little late, but not very late. In fact, we were already imperializing our American Indians and so forth. And then we jump to the Philippines and Cuba and whatnot. So everybody gets in it, and there is this wave of violence against people that were supposed to be either liberating these countries from or against folks who oppose our rule in a given place. There's this huge outbreak of violent behavior, and it's a pattern. Then that as we know from our own times, there's this blowback. In other words, if you have an empire, then your own society becomes more brutal. And this is certainly one thing that happened. The reason I include these two photographs on this particular slide are to make these connections. Here's the Wounded Knee mass burial, which was actually just an execution of people who had thought they'd surrendered, probably. And then here's the execution of a soldier in World War One, a French soldier who had engaged in a mutiny. Not that he went against his country, he just refused to get out of the trench and be murdered in one more futile charge. That was the French mutiny in 1917. So you get these two mutinies going on, and this kind of death, it became something that Europeans were inured to, that they were accustomed to, and all that. So one of the things about the war was that it made into a, at least on the war fronts, into an everyday thing, these patterns of brutality. And that's an important part of the way the war was fought. It was fought, the numbers of civilians killed in the war went up drastically. The attitudes towards civilians, the shooting of civilians was falling, the burning of towns. And it wasn't just the Germans. They certainly did these dastardly things, and so did the Russians, and so did the Turks, and so did everybody did that type of thing in a given situation. So let me turn now from the nature of war as a violent and brutal thing to the aspect of it that contributes to the health of the state. Everybody knows, I'm sure in this audience knows, Randolph Bourne's great dictum that war is the health of the state. Let me just say that three points about this overall brilliant insight are important to kind of disambiguate. One is that there was enormous growth of government and a destruction of liberty. All right, that government grew and it had to grow vis-a-vis decisions made by individuals. In other words, it had to grow with the result of the destruction of liberty. There is in this period a tendency to nationalize resources. Oh, and by the way, now we have the Gorham's essay up. And to nationalize resources, that is either confiscate or buy out at bargain prices, businesses, enterprises, land, and whatnot, and nationalize those resources. There is propaganda, information control. There is surveillance. The surveillance state was certainly, I don't want to say born, but it was certainly in its infancy in World War I and grew up quite a bit. And then finally, of course, there's massive economic intervention. All of these things in all the belligerent countries, let me say that again, all of these things in all the belligerent countries. One of the healthiest things I think about the Austrian approach, or we want to call this the liberal revisionist approach to history, is that you get to blame everybody who needs to be blamed. You don't have to feel compelled to defend your own state, because in some sense, the states do things that are illegitimate. And I mean, you may think that everything the state does is illegitimate. I sort of do too. But I'm saying that you don't have to justify the evil actions of your country. And for those people who were conservatives, who are on their way to being libertarians, this is a great freedom, I think. It's a great sense of relief that you don't have to make excuses. You don't have to say, well, you know, those Indians probably needed harsh treatment, or this group or that. You just say, well, it's the state. The state does it. So anyway, that's part of the nature of war, and it goes overall. We're going to talk about some aspects of wartime things that bleed into the post-war, and we're going to talk about a lot of different countries. It's going to be a really good world history. Now, another aspect of the nature of this First World War that flows into the post-war period is this. It's expressed by Murray Rothbard's brilliant essay, War as Fulfillment. Okay, and I'll make a couple of points about that. That's on the reading list, and I know that many of you have already read that. Many of you have read probably quite a few of the readings on the list, but I hope you'll read them again if you get the chance. So, first of all, the modern state redistributes more or less constantly among individuals and groups, and in wartime, this, like other trends, is intensified. Secondly, with war coming on, with war going on, some individuals and some groups realize that their agenda, and it could be any number of things. It doesn't have to be power and wealth. It could be status, a new status, a heaven on earth. It could be you just. Well, there are any number of goals that people have, but humans being humans and groups being groups, then what happens is that these groups, when they live in a state that is constantly brokering the resources of everybody and can take from this one and give to this one, then some people see that and try to take advantage. And so there's all of that going on, and war is fulfillment, then, as Rothbard says, then becomes the fulfillment of this whatever it is that you want. Third, under the welfare version of the state in particular, a continual process of this corporatism, and that's this balancing out of the different interests of the corpora, the bodies of society. Corporatism assures a continual plunder of those who don't get their program chosen, who don't have their fulfillment chosen. Now, this applies to all welfare states, and especially democracies. In a sense, the states that are not democracies or that are the least democratic in World War I had the least of this process of fulfillment and plunder, though they certainly had it. But I think on a comparative note, that's an important thing to say. Well, there are many other things that we can observe about World War I and that we will observe later, but we need to move on. Let's turn now to the issue of American interests. I have a picture there of the Zimmerman telegram. Everybody knows that's a part of the justification for entering. And then, of course, here's an artist's cool version of the Singing of Lusitania by a German submarine. Well, this didn't happen until, one important thing is the date. And I put the date the first thing because so many Americans are not totally familiar with the fact that we only got into the last few months of the war, really. In spending time in Europe and in Britain and so forth, and often studying some aspect of World War I in the archives or something, I often talk to Europeans or even Britons who say, so you're interested in World War I? Well, I guess the United States wasn't in that war, right? In other words, to them it was their war. And it is a fact that from August 1914 until April 1917, it was certainly their war. But we got into it. Well, I'm sure also that everybody in this class has an idea of Woodrow Wilson and a kind of concept of Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson is often sold by, I would say, sort of mainstream historians and the mainstream media as a man of vision and a kind of man of peace and international order and understanding and so forth and so on. And he certainly was a man of vision. He was a man whose vision was that the United States could be, under his leadership, his presidency, a kind of new force in the world. It could be a force that kind of invoked covenants and established open covenants, openly arrived at, and peace in our time, and a kind of millennial idea. At the same time that he himself was prosecuting war after war after war before he got the United States into World War I. Indeed, even as the war started, Woodrow Wilson, a hardcore Anglophile, was never, ever going to be on the side of Germany. Although some 40-45% of Americans had some German heritage. I mean, if that was the funny thing is, later he argued for national self-determination based on ethnic groups. But we went to war against Germany when there were all these ethnic Germans in the United States. But we carried out a very unneutral neutrality in spite of Wilson saying he wanted just to be fair to everybody. The United States, as we'll see, gave massive loans to the Entente powers, and the Allied side is also called the Entente side. The German, Austrian, Turkish side is called the Central Power side, of course, and The two powers could deal with our neutral country, but they dealt with us on a very unequal basis, whether it was for loans, whether it was purchases, whether it was just for newspaper propaganda. Both sides tried, but only the British could get that done, really. Only the Entente could get that done. So there's a very unneutral neutrality that went on. Since the United States had loaned so much under this unequal neutrality to France, Britain, and Belgium, then the United States eventually, when push came to shove, when the Allies began to lose, when it looked like there would be such a draw that there would be, that it would not approximate anything like a victory where you could get your money back, then the United States did go to war, did intervene. So there's a literature on this, and I'm just summarizing here, and mainstream historians say, well, this is not the only reason. Wilson had these ideological reasons and so forth. And I'm certain that Wilson didn't understand all the reasons that this segment of society and this segment were supporting him. And I'm not sure he asked any questions of that type. But certainly he was supported by the J.P. Morgan people and all the international banks and the arms manufacturers and so forth. Okay, so saving the Allies meant saving that money invested in the Allies, right? Now, the question sometimes it has to come up, did this make a difference? Well, yes, it made all the difference in the war. The American entry made all the difference. Here's the thing. As of 1916, the Allies, by the end of 1916, the Allies were on the map. In early 1917, they were wondering how they could move forward. In a few months later, in at the end of April, beginning of May 1917, the French army mutinied over maybe a third of its piece of the Western Front. And that man being shot, whose picture I showed you long ago, it was about not being murdered anymore after the Nivelle Offensive of the early spring of 1917. And so the French had collapsed. The French could mount no offensive operations from that point on. They were too busy shooting their own people. And the British had to take over more of the line. Everybody's thinking now, what if we have to negotiate a peace? Well, that would be horrible, because then you can't get the spoils. If you're not a victor, you don't get the spoils. So did it make a difference that the United States came in? Well, yeah. In 1913, I'll give you an example of how it can make a difference. The GDP of the United States was the same as, in fact, a little more than the whole Entente without Russia. And to tell you the truth, if you threw Russia in, it's nearly that big. Not quite, but nearly. The United States had been the leading economic force in the world in trade, manufacturing, since 1900 by a long shot. So if the most powerful, so if a country that's producing as much as your whole side suddenly joins you, then there's no way that's not going to make a huge difference, all right? And of course, the Germans knew, and the Austrians and the Turks knew that if the Americans got in, then they had to do some pretty razzle-dazzle moves to beat the Entente powers before the Americans got over. But that's a little bit of that later. Once the Americans entered the war, as we shall see, it took a while to get troops on the ground. In fact, about 10 months to get troops on the ground. And you had these two things kind of happening at once. You have the shady Colonel House, the alter ego of Woodrow Wilson. I'm sorry to say he's a Texan, but went from Houston. What can you say about that? I hope there's nobody on here from Houston. I know I saw somebody from Dallas-Fort Worth, but I'm just joking about Houston. We had a good meeting in Houston last week. I wasn't there, but it looked great. So anyway, I'm just joking about Houston. Colonel House was from Houston, and he played a game of kind of soft negotiation, kind of wanting to be the universal spider, the man who put all this thing together. And frankly, he'd pretty much done the job as Woodrow Wilson's emissary, getting Wilson into the war and getting the Allies to welcome them in certain ways. And so you have him. On the other hand, you have Pershing, who arrives with his staff and no soldiers really, and only to have the other Allies tell him, well, you don't really need units. All you need to do is give us the soldiers, and we'll just put them in our own units, and Don't worry about officers. We've got our own. Pershing, however, with no real orders on this, just personally said, no, that's not the way we're going to do it. We're going to build an army, and we're going to fight on the Western Front. And by the way, British, I don't like the way you hold those trenches. I think you're a little too much attached to your trenches. And so we're going to train with them. They know how to attack. So anyway, there are these two things kind of going on. And so the inter-allied diplomacy is of interest here. There were frictions already, and in fact, differing voices within each camp before the... I hear a cat. Can you hear that? Well, I don't own a cat. I don't know what's going on. But anyway, there's a phantom cat in my house. Yeah. Oh, now I'm looking down. I see that there is some audio distortion. Is there? Could that have been just a cat? I guess it's a cat who came out of the trenches. Malcolm, yes. Okay. Anyway, Jeff can't hear it. Cam heard something but didn't know if it was a cat. Okay, no cat. Well, I just heard a cat. Very loud, as if you were in my house. But anyway, another part of American entry is this little part, a broad issue is this. As you know, the Bolsheviks carried out their revolution beginning in October, November 1917. And there had already been a first Russian revolution in which the Tsar and his family, which the monarchy was overthrown, back in February, March 1917. And that government, that provisional government that had taken over in March 1917 had wanted above all to stay in the war. But the Bolsheviks were openly committed to pulling out of the war. So once they took over the government, then everybody knew Russia would, in days, months, weeks, whatever, be no longer in the war. And once the Germans and Austrians didn't have to fight the Russians on the Eastern Front, then the Germans would have plenty of troops to rush to the Western Front. And by the way, the Austrians would have plenty of troops to rush to the Italian front and carry out a massive assault on both of those kind of stalemated fronts. So once the Americans entered, then you see that leaves this real problem. From the standpoint of the Germans and the Austrians, well, the Americans can get a whole lot of troops and materiel and so forth over to Europe. The materiel comes first and the money comes first and all that, and then the troops will come. But if the Bolsheviks take Russia out of the war, then we'll use that window in time to win in Europe. And by the time the Americans get here, there won't be anything to do, or they'll decide not to come if everybody collapses before then. So there's that aspect to all this. And so we'll talk more about American intervention, but I think those broad issues are some of the most important ones. Here's an issue I want to talk about throughout the war. This goes for every country. All belligerents inflated their currency to help finance the war, though to different extents. These post-war hyperinflations that we know about, everybody knows the most about the German one. There was an equally bad hyperinflation in Austria, equally bad hyperinflation in Hungary, and other places had things that were approaching hyperinflation. So we know about the post-war hyperinflations a little bit more, but the inflation really started in the war because war brings inflation, because governments simply print up money and expand credit, use other means to steal money from people and plunder people during wartime, in addition to the taxes that they're taking and the goods that they're confiscating and all those things. So, for example, in Austria, food prices rose during the war by a factor of 16. In Germany, Britain, and France, it was much less, but all belligerents experienced this type of thing. in essence, this inflation regime of World War I, and to tell you the truth, this is, although inflation wasn't not nearly invented here, and you know, we've had a fun course on the history of inflation, wasn't nearly invented here, but boy, it really became the tool of choice here. And all the belligerents suddenly discovered, the Germans, the first day of the war, pretty much just say, no more gold standard. We're just going to do, you know, the Federal Reserve had been in effect elsewhere. The Reichsbank was a little bit more hard-nosed, but not much. And so that's the German central bank. And so so everybody just kind of says, oh, wartime, inflation. And this becomes the kind of inflation regime. And that, of course, will very much impact, as much as anything, this internal process of inflation, of fiat money and all of that is going to affect the whole picture. Now, a separate issue is international finance, and I've already touched on it very, very briefly. One thing is really important here, and increasingly important in my mind, the more I know about it. There's the imperial world. Had this process going on. Imperial countries, Britain, the United States, France, even Russia, Belgium, especially Belgium, the bankers and the governments in those countries worked together in this kind of warfare, welfare state sort of way to gain access to colonies so that they could invest in those, in particular, big infrastructural investments, and especially railroads. And so they pushed railroads in, and then in the countries where they started building them, they would get those governments to contribute by borrowing money to help pay for the railroads, and then, or the other infrastructure. And then, since those loans were basically designed to get those countries in the kind of financial thraldom, then this was a way also to bind the country more closely to the imperial power. Now, if you follow this, this whole railroad history goes right up to World War I, and it's a part of this, a part of the process that we're going to see open up again in the 20s. And indeed, the Allies, that one of the first things they do after the inflation is settled and so forth in Germany, is that they arrange to take over the German railroads. But these this series of loans, often by consortia, are handed over to China. They're handed over, their loans are handed, and then China has a revolution as a result of the destabilization of the government because of loans. Loans are offered to Mexico. Same thing happens. There's a revolution. In other words, in fact, loans are offered to Russia too, and Russia also has a revolution. So in the wake of the loans comes a government that's strapped for cash, that cuts back and raises taxes to try to pay for it and whatnot. And then there's revolution at home. So there's a whole history of this sort of financial manipulation that goes on before the war. One piece of this financial picture of international finance was the huge 1893-94 French loan to Russia. For reasons we won't go into, France and Russia got together in the year 1892-93, and when they negotiated an alliance, the Franco-Russian alliance, part of that was that the French floated one of the largest loans ever on the French bond market, so that French citizens subscribed to loaning money to Russia. The Russians wanted to do some top-down industrial lending. They really didn't have a saving class or a large middle class, and so the government decided to do it on its own. And so French citizens bought these Russian bonds And then the Russians used the money, the Russian government used the money to invest their lives and move forward in that way. By the way, inadvertently building factories where then socialists and Bolsheviks and others could radicalize the working people. But be that as it may, the Russians had these enormous debts. And so this helped start the war for sure. I mean, because once the Russians declared war on the Austrians, then the French couldn't see any way out. I mean, they were going to save their money that they had loaned to Russia. The French public wanted to see France go into the war and protect the, you know, on the side of the Russians. So that's a part of this whole history. A second part is that beginning, really with the beginning of the war, only a few weeks into it, the Americans started. The American government paved the way for international banks, in particular J.P. Morgan, who had an office in London anyway. The Americans started to give massive loans, as I mentioned already, to Belgium, France, and to Britain, so that the war, a big chunk of it was financed by American money, and there were enormous war debts. And the theory is the same with the French people financing the Russians. When they're successful in some way, then they'll pay it all back. And in this case, you want to know that they're successful in war so that they will pay the money back. Now, note here, the longer the war goes on, the more treasures blown up on the battlefield, the more shells, artillery shells have to be made, the more artillery pieces wear out, have to be redone, the more the economies get hollowed out in this process. And so, everybody needs more money, and they keep asking for more. And you know, the people who are really winning in this would be J.P. Morgan, who also happened to become the British purchasing agent in the United States, as well as the chief supplier of loans. So the big winners would be these huge investment banks and the Rothschild interest in both Europe and America, and then the arms and war material manufacturers, who often were quite closely connected to the big banking houses that had been one of the 19th century goals, and so they achieved that. So these are the big winners in this picture. But before I go to that next part, I do want to say that this internal financing of the war is going to be crucial to know about as we move into the 1920s and talk about the Dawes Plan and the Young Plan. This is background that we need to have in the back of our minds. Okay, well, I'd like to turn to the battlefield now and talk about talk a little bit about how the war ended. I mean, the real battlefield war ended, at least on the Western Front. I can't narrate the whole thing, and I admit, I'm partial here to the story of the Western Front, but of course there's the Russian front in the east, there's the Italian front, the Turks have three fronts going on, there's actually three different Italian fronts. There's the war in Romania, there's the war, it just goes on and on and on. So I'm not going to narrate the whole thing, but we can do well enough with just a single narration of the biggest, most human being packed front for the smallest area, and that was the Western Front, where the Germans faced the British, French, Belgians, and Americans, and eventually Portuguese and some others too. Okay, well, just as the givens, the data, right? The givens here are that in terms of demography and in terms of much else, the Central Powers were winning in 1917. And we have suspected that. We know it since Niall Ferguson established this fact in The Pity of War. And you say his name and people go crazy. But in this particular case, I'll say this. He made an interesting calculation. He just ran the numbers and he figured out that that if the Germans keep killing British and French at the rate that the British and French, at the rate they are, and the British and French keep killing the Germans, and then you run their population figures, that the Germans win. In other words, if it's a race to the finish, if it's a war of total desolation, then the Germans win. There are all kinds of indications that this would be the case, that the British were getting shaky, where they put a good face on it, they weren't going to admit it, above all to their investors, the Americans, but that was clearly the case. The British pulled out the stops to get the Americans in. They drew up that Bryce report of atrocities in Germany. They did everything. It was a desperate back to the wall situation. So the Central Powers were, by a little bit, winning in 1917. That's one given. Another given is that the first Russian Revolution, that's the one that ended with the provisional government, that revolution made it very clear that the Entente had been weakened. In other words, you can't have a revolt that kicks out the king in your allied country during war and not say, not be at least a little bit worried. See what I mean? So there was extreme concern, even though the provisional government wanted to stay in the war. And people thought, well, what happens next? You know, you never know where a revolution goes, and Europeans know that above all people. So those are givens. Another couple of givens. The Americans couldn't get troops to Europe sooner than about 10 months. And the Germans knew, give or take, how that would work. In other words, they understand people who could calculate that and know that it might be that Pershing arrived with a few dozen staff officers, but that's a very different thing from getting a division on European soil, and indeed a trained division that could go into the front. So after April 6th, the clock is ticking, and then there's all these Americans who will be flooding over. But on the other hand, November 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution took Russia out of the war. Well, it took a couple of months, but immediately the fronts collapsed. Some local commanders organized resistance to the Austrians and Germans longer than others, but for the most part, the soldiers just went home. And so, officially, the Bolsheviks were out of the war by just a couple months later, the early March in 1918. Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. These are all givens. In other words, you have this thing about the window. So what happens next? If the front collapses, then, and there's a stalemate on the Western front, and suddenly the Russians can take 400,000, 500,000, 600,000, 100,000 troops from the Eastern front, move those, bring as much war material as they can muster, and bring those to the West, then that could be the difference. And you've got 10 months, you've got about, well, not 10 months, you've got a few months to do that. So those are the data, and given that data, the Germans made this decision to launch an all-out assault in that window, before the Americans could get there, and as soon as the troops could be pulled off the Eastern Front and integrated into the Western Front. And the results were called the Spring Offensive, or the Kaiserschlacht, the Kaiser's Battle. The head of the executive commanding general, not the high commander, but the quartermaster general of the German army, Ludendorff, did the planning. They used the tactics of a brilliant German general named Gutier, and basically gave birth to Blitzkrieg. That is, not the idea of going forward like the British on the Somme on a front that was 11 miles wide, but rather poking a hole in the enemy's line, going as far and as fast to the rear as you can, and then waiting for the enemy to become disorganized and disintegrate. So that was the idea, and Ludendorff gathered a huge, huge army to carry out this battle, and that battle was launched on the 21st of March, 1918. It doesn't look like much on this map, but for a front that hadn't moved 10 feet either way, I'm exaggerating only a little, for a front that hadn't moved 10 feet either way since the beginning of the war, This is huge. If you look at those pinkish areas and so forth, those are the areas where the Western Front had expanded. In other words, where the German army beat back the British and the French in the spring of in the spring offensive. It was a fierce battle. Which area? Okay. I do have a little cursor here, don't I? Is this the one? Where's my cursor? Is it that arrow? Ah, can everybody see that? I hope you can. So, yes, some here. Here, these gains here, which is, I mean, it's a big map. From here, for example, from here to down here is about 400 miles if you follow the line of the front. And so these are good sized gains, and they're strategic gains too. In many cases, they're taking the high ground, the next ridge over from the high ground that they were occupying. So there are gains all along. This huge bulge here is really pretty sizable. So no cursor? How about now? The thick arrow. Yeah, I'm using the thick arrow. Can you see it? Okay. All right. So from here at the top of the Western Front to down here, that's 400 miles. And so you get a sense of how much of that front there was breakthrough. So the spring offensive started over here, because that's the German side, and moved, I can't reverse my cursor, but anyway, moves this way. And you see it moves toward the sea. All right. So it was successful, except that the Americans got there, and the first American troops, I should say, entered the line. If it's pretty small, I can't see all the places, but entered the line roughly here at Chateau Thierry and Belleau Wood, They were fighting in these spots with every kind of colonial troop that the British and French could wang together and get to the front line, because it was an all-out desperate struggle. And the American units went in first in full force. A few had been fighting earlier and sometimes with French units. They shored things up, and as many Americans know, Belleau Wood and Chateau Thierry were American victories where they stopped that. That was part of the spring offensive. So once the offensive was stopped, end of May, in June, in the early days of July, then the Germans had pretty much done what they could. They had pretty much shot their bolt and didn't have much more to do. The German commander, I should say this, I mean, the German commander was looking at Pershing forming the first American First Army. He reduced the Samiel salient September 1918. Just a few days later, his chief of staff, Lord Marshall, planned the Meuse-Argonne offensive, and that opened just days later. Two more American armies are formed and joined in. So we're talking now about 280,000 American troops on the front, grinding away and pushing the Germans back in lines that literally, those lines, some of them had not moved a foot since the beginning of the war, and the Americans were grinding those back, and that allowed the British to attack on their part of the line, and the French even to attack on their part of the line in the famous 100 Days Battle, of which you might say that the Meuse-Argonne offensive was a part, though, to tell you the truth, I think the Meuse-Argonne offensive made it possible. So the Germans are looking at that. They're looking at the Allies grinding in. Ludendorff has two or three nervous breakdowns. It's bad when he's the commander of the army. And he finally, at the beginning of September, wires the German government to say, you know, you got to surrender. We're beaten. He changed his mind later and claimed that he hadn't quite said that, but he really did. I've seen his note. he said, you know, we just can't stay in this thing. So, get past that point. I don't want to do it. So what happened was that this 100 Days Battle ground on, the German, we're going to see that the Germans changed their government to try to correspond more to what the Allies might deal with. But basically, the Allies ground on. Now, I'll have to say this. By the time of the armistice at November 11th, the Germans were still occupying, I'll go back to that. The Germans were still, you can see this, these markers, they were still, you know, the front was way over here. It was just a little bit to the east of where they, the 100 days moved the line back, but not that much. And so the German army was really, to tell you the truth, it was not beaten. Now, the commander thought it would collapse, but it was not annihilated or pushed off of French or Belgian soil. I mean, they still had to leave Belgium and France, which they had held parts of for the whole war. So this is a part of the process. I mean, later on, German politicians, including Hitler, are going to say, well, how's that work when your army's not beaten and then you surrender? So that's going to be a question that everybody has to deal with. Okay, so the war, it's going to be over by November 11th, and I'll describe. Maybe I should go through my other. Maybe I should not go to. I'll come back to mere statistics. Okay, I'll just put that slide in a little odd place. What happens here is that a couple of things. First of all, a number of people tried to negotiate or help negotiate a peace during the war, notably the Pope, who tried to get the sides to come together and talk. In January 1918, Woodrow Wilson gave a speech in which he, remember, we're still nickel in January 1918, he gave a speech in which he said, okay, here's the 14 points for peace. He hadn't consulted anybody. None of his allies, you know, the people who are going to be his allies, none of the people who, nobody knew anything about it. But it was a kind of Presbyterian plan for world domination. I can say that I work for a Presbyterian college, okay? So it was a kind of a plan to have open covenants. Doesn't that sound great? Sounds biblical. Open covenants openly arrived at. And even the language is, you know, kind of clunky. It's kind of Old Testament-ish. He said in the 14 points of Belgium that it should be evacuated and restored, and all these other countries that have been invaded should be restored. No telling what that meant, but it's in there, restored. Poland is in four of the points. So four of 14 points have to do with Poland. I've been asked that by students before, and my infallible reply is, well, in the city of Chicago alone, there were more Poles in 1918 than there were in any city in the world except for Warsaw, and nearly all of them voted Democratic. So you can understand a little bit how Poland comes to be featured so prominently in the 14 points. But all countries should be have their borders adjusted according to lines of nationality, he says. Now, he uses eventually the term national self-determination, but here in the 14 points, he's saying nationality. He's saying also that trade should be equalized and there should be then this league of the, you know, this great league of the covenant. But he's really basing this on ethnic nationality. And so these are the terms, okay? Well, the Germans and the Austrians saw in this some chance of negotiation, okay? Here's an opinion. Here's a couple of commentaries on the 14 points. And I think this one by Czernin, who is the foreign minister of Austria, is worth reading. The Allied statesmen were faced with a problem. So far, they had considered the 14 commandments as a piece of clever and effective American propaganda designed primarily to undermine the fighting spirit of the Central Powers and to bolster the morale of the lesser allies. Now, suddenly, the whole peace structure was supposed to be built on that set of vague principles most of which seemed to them thoroughly unrealistic, and some of which, if they were to be seriously applied, were simply unacceptable. So that's from a post-war perspective that Chernin wrote this. The French Prime Minister, Georges Clemenceau, later to be the most unfriendly friend to Woodrow Wilson, just said simply, le bon Dieu n'en avait que dix. The Lord God himself only had 10. Look at Woodrow Wilson. He got 14. So anyway, that's just a little commentary, and I think it gives you a sense of how that went. But in any case, this made a difference. It really did. The Allies started changing. The Austrians started loosening up their political structure a little bit. The Germans loosened theirs a lot. The military commanders had had a military dictatorship going. They were removed from power. A new commander was reliable, was brought in. A new prime minister, the liberal Prince Max of Baden, was brought in to create a government at the beginning of October. And immediately, the Germans started talking constitutional reform and how to make a more equitable constitutional system with all kinds of rights to people who hadn't had any and so forth. So they were all making changes in hopes of negotiating better through Wilson, who was now, of course, in the war against them. these changes didn't amount to everything. I mean, once the armistice negotiations started in the beginning of October in the Belgian watering hole, the spring, you know, spa town of Spa, during the month of October, the Germans, a German commission went and sat down with an inter-allied commission and worked out the terms of an armistice, and we'll see about that in a minute. But meanwhile, while they were sitting there, the Turks surrendered via the armistice of Mudros on October 30th. The war was there were already Allied troops on Turkish soil, not just the Empire soil, but actually Turkey, and they fell apart. The Allies immediately occupied Istanbul, and the war was over for the Turks. Austria-Hungary fell apart. It fell in the course of the last days of October into its constituent pieces. It was a huge, big empire consisting of what's today the Czech Republic and Hungary and parts of Italy and parts of Balkan countries and parts of Switzerland, you name it. And it fell into its constituent pieces at the end of October, and then they negotiated a surrender that came on November 3rd. So here's the New York Times, armistice signed, end of the war, Berlin seized by revolutionists. We'll talk about that next time. A new chancellor begs for order, blah, blah, blah. And that's the newspaper from those days. After the Armistice Commission did its work, I think it didn't do a very good job. I think the Germans could have held out for more, but they didn't. For a number of reasons, it looked very grim to them with all those Americans swarming into Europe. And so the Armistice Commission negotiated an armistice that looked exactly like a total surrender, not a negotiating peace kind of thing. For one thing, they had to disarm. For another thing, they had to pull back not just to German borders, but inside German borders to a distance of a number of kilometers. They had to withdraw from certain pieces of Germany. They had to pile up all their weapons and airplanes. In other words, it was severe. The Allies did what they could to make sure that the Germans could not start up the war again. And then the actual armistice agreement was signed on a battlefield, and they built railroad tracks swerving around so that these tracks came right next to each other in the forest of Compiègne. And on the day assigned, November 8th, 1918, the German train rode through the forest of Compiègne, and the French were waiting, and the Germans pulled up. And that's how that railway car stuff happened. That's where they did the negotiating, and that's where they signed the surrender. And there's a picture of the French proudly standing outside their their railway car. So let's see, where do we go from here? Is that it? Okay, well, so that's my last slide, which means I'm nearly through the lecture. But let me just say this. I think that although we've kind of stayed inside the war, it's really, really important that we do this so that we know what comes next. I mean, so that we know what, when there's a revolution in Germany that we need to follow next week, we need to think about that. We need to think about these financial things very, very carefully. We need to understand a little bit about the populations. I should mention that the Germans were starving, the Austrians were starving. Not only was food expensive, it was non-existent. And so there are many, many processes here from the war that keep going in the post-war period and are the background for the ending of that war. And we'll talk then about the Paris peace next time. But meanwhile, the Allies decided, I mean, the deal was, okay, the next thing is we've got the armistice. Now we have the peace conference immediately. And where will we have it? And they decided to have it in Paris, where people hated Germans more than anywhere else. And they decided that, you know, the heads of state would come there and do the negotiating and have people to work out committees and so forth. And so Woodrow Wilson, after the end of December 1918, got on the good ship, the George Washington, and sailed across the Atlantic and started a triumphal tour of a number of European cities before he rounded back up to Paris and to start the conference on January 11th. And that's where we'll begin the lecture next time. Okay. Oh, that's right. I didn't go through, thank you, Samir. I didn't go through the stats. Let's do that. It's a good time to do it. Perfect. I should have put that here anyway. So, yeah. Okay. So, it'd be just sort of random. I mean, you can look at in the end of the book, I have some statistics, and there's all kinds of collections. I mean, there's a million things you could want to know about the end of the war, but these are just, in my mind, kind of evocative. 42.2 million soldiers were mobilized for the Entente, and of those, 5.1 million were killed. That's a lot. That's a lot. Total military deaths on both sides, about 10 million, just under 10 million. Total and indirect civilian deaths, direct and indirect, at 6.8 some odd million. None of this reflects the people who were disabled or died later. I think of this often because my own my grandfather's brother, a great uncle of mine, whom I never knew because he died in 1929, having been gassed in 1918. So, you know, there are people like him whose lives were destroyed and then ended, but who really don't get counted in these totals. The war expanded the use of internee and other concentration camps, identifying enemies and putting them in the locking them up. That had already existed before the war, but accelerated it. The war produced millions of refugees. The war devastated huge regions of Europe. There's more about that in the in my book, of which I get in that last chapter of it that I give you. Ethnic cleansing was accelerated as ethnic identity became even more paramount during this war. We're going to see that the height of nationalism is really not quite so much before the war, but after. Which of us could count all the malinvestments, the lives of work not done, the people whose creativity was cut short by being killed or by being herded into some a different avenue? It's almost the costs of the war are almost inconceivable. And private life, the assault on private life is not the least of these kinds of things. In terms of governments, as Higgs shows in such abundant detail, It was a massive growth. The United States alone added 500,000 government employees to the payroll. The cost of the war just for the United States was about $32 billion, which sounds like pocket change these days. But it, in those dollars at those times, those good gold-backed dollars, that was about 52% of the GNP. So we're talking about a war that was incredibly wasting. And I just want to point out that the largest American military cemetery outside the United States is the Meuse-Argonne Cemetery, and that's because there were so many people killed in proximity to that cemetery, whereas you think of Normandy or something, but this is a much larger one. Okay, well, then that's the lecture, and you know, I haven't done too badly for the having to lay the ground rules and everything. I've done this, and now we have plenty of time to sit back and take a little more relaxed approach, and you can raise questions or make comments, and I'll either respond or ignore you, whichever seems most politic to me. So I'm just kidding. All questions answered. I will say this though: in our questions and answers, sometimes in the past, somebody will. They'll be sitting at home on their computer looking up, like, you know, original texts and Wikipedia entries and, you know, their college textbook or something. And they'll give me these things to say, well, what do you think about this three paragraph passage? But I really can't do that in this format. So, you're welcome to ask all that on the forums and get some responses. And I go on there too. And, you know, I'm all for everybody being engaged on these forums and discussing. But for now, let's do the things that can be done in this format and save the other for the other thing. Okay. And I am looking at and is Nathan the first question? I think so. Yeah, he put this on a long time ago. After a crisis subsides, when there is a ratcheting back of the size and scope of government, is there a pattern as to which of the new members of government are kicked out of the club? Does it usually depend on the next political regime? Yeah, I think that's it. I think it does depend. It depends on who won and who lost, and I mean losers in the economy and in society and in politics, and partly you know, if you're on the losing, and if we're talking about, say, the losing end, I mean, the Germans were actually that government too, but some of the racketers had already been kicked out before the end of the war because the Germans were losing. Because the state took such a hammer blow, it had to back off, you see. So, and then immediately after Prince Max, there was a German revolution where theoretically, the have-nots were taking power. It's a complicated thing. I'll talk a little bit about it next week. But yeah, I think it just depends on the situation. I don't think one size fits all there. And you know, when I think of the regimes that emerged from this war, you know, I think it might be better to lose. For the state to lose such a thing because the state is not back just a little. Brad, hey Brad, how you doing? He says libertarians tend to be on the side of not entering World War I and World War II. The argument is that pacifism would have led to German expansion and evil rulers. What do you speculate would have happened if the U.S. had stayed out of World War I? I'm convinced, Brad, that if we'd stayed out of World War I, that there would have been a negotiated peace. I can't, now, I mean, that's counterfactual history, but all indications to me, in my mind, are that both sides were about to wear out and that nobody wanted to carry out this kind of war to the last man. I mean, I just don't think the publics would have stood it. There were all kinds of signs of revolt and social disturbances and strikes. I mean, in Scotland on the Tyne River estuary, there was strike after strike after strike in all those coal mines and so forth. So anyway, it's, and the strike activity in Germany from 1970s going up, up, up. people were just absolutely sick of the war, sick of the conditions, sick of the bill of fare or the no bill of fare. And so I think the countries would have been forced to negotiate. And to me, that would have been far, far better solution. And also, to me, and this is, again, counterfactual, and I'm a historian, I'm about what actually did happen, you know, all that. But I will say this, I can't see World War One happening, at least in the way that it happened. I can't see Hitler emerging, at least in the way that he emerged, and with the result that he had without the First World War. And without the American intervention, without this last minute, 11th hour change of pace, so that the Germans thought they were working out a kind of money kind of a peace, maybe, or could look at that. And then suddenly you have this juggernaut that's all over you and defeats you really rapidly. So that's my idea about that, Brad. Let's see. A lot of great questions here. Okay. Hi, Malcolm. How you doing? Would you please distinguish between the executions during World War One for mutiny versus desertion? Can you compare the history of execution for disagreeing with war, desertion, and mutiny, each being a different parameter of behavior to that which happened in World War One? In World War One, both the British and the French, and I guess the Germans, treated mutiny and desertion as pretty much the same thing. They just shot them. They didn't shoot every single person. And after the French mutiny, there were so many hundreds of thousands of soldiers there that they didn't execute all of them. They sent some of them off to the penal colony in the New World and put others in prisons, and then shot a few hundred. The British shot over the period of the war a few hundred for cowardice, but there were a few mutinies. There was a mutiny that happened at the British training camp in Europe, and they shot a few over that. The ringleaders, mainly. And then people who deserted, they got the same. So they're two different crimes, so to speak, but crimes in that sense. But as you say, I mean, they're related, but they both got shot for that. And then of course, disagreeing with the war, there could be conscientious objectors. Now, they weren't handled very gently in World War One, and most of them were put to hard labor or something. But you know, the state didn't just shoot people that, and you know that. But I'm saying there is a clear difference in the mind of the state. You could get off the hook a little bit with the conscientious thing. Even though the mutineers on the front, I think, were partly conscientious objectors, but be that as it may. I'm not sure that answers your question, Malcolm, but let me know if it doesn't. Yeah, about a third of the French lines mutiny. The British, as I mentioned, the British had a big mutiny occur at Etaples in 1918. That was their French training camp. Their French area where people were trained before they went to the front, where their main staging area at Etaples. And it was a really grim, awful place. And even the guys from the front would come back to Etaples and have these Etaples, I should say, and have these non-coms who had never set foot on the Western Front boss them around and try to humiliate them and so forth. So there was a mutiny there, and they did shoot some over that. There was a number of mutinies in the Middle East, some others there. As far as, let's see, what's the other army? I don't think there was ever a mutiny in the Australian contingents of the British Army or the Scots. These were mainly the English units. But in Germany and Austria, there's not much in the way of mutiny there. I'm not sure about the Italians. And the Russians, of course, at the end of the war, part of the front collapsing was certainly mutinies, but these were mutinies when they knew that the Bolsheviks were already about to take power at home. So there were mutinies around. I mean, if you really went into it to get each individual one, you find quite a few actually, but the French mutiny is the biggest one by far of the war. Malcolm says, how do you think the development, the successive development of communism would have been different if the Americans had not entered the war? Do you think communism in Russia would have collapsed? Well, that's a good question. That's hard to say. And again, these kind of factual things, you know, we can only guess. I'm trying to think what pressures. I mean, if the Allies could have intervened a little bit more at a little bit earlier date in the Bolshevik Revolution, maybe the regime would have collapsed. I mean, they barely had a finger hold on the government, but you get into the Civil War in 1918, about 3 or 4 or 5 months, and then suddenly the Bolsheviks look pretty strong. So I don't know. I guess if there had been an earlier intervention, some possibility of that. I don't think that the war itself was causing, in other words, the war being fought now that Lenin was no longer fighting, I don't think that caused him to do anything much different from what he might otherwise have done. But of course, who knows? That's a good question. Do you think that after America entered the war, do you think that Germany could have fought defensively to a detente? I'm not sure what you mean, Malcolm. Can you rephrase that one and plug it in again? Maggie. Hi, Maggie. How you doing? Do you know which of any miniseries that have been done on World War One are most accurate, or least politically one-sided? Yeah. Well, I know we're all thinking about Downton Abbey. I mean, that could be almost, you know, the interwar period with the effects of the war going on. That could be almost like our theme show for at least part of this course. And to tell you the truth, I mean, that's a fair look at a little slice of life. Of course, it's not all about the war, but I think that's a pretty fair shot at all this. The mini series. You know, some of these I haven't seen, Maggie, and so some could be quite good. In a way, I've gotten the last, you know, 10 or 11 years, I've been so saturated with the actual writing about it. I haven't had much of a heart to watch many of the World War One things. I will say this. I think maybe the best war, I think there are two older movies that are the best World War One movies, in my opinion. And one is Kirk Douglas's movie that he made. He got specifically Stanley Kubrick, the young Stanley Kubrick, to direct it as his first movie. In the 1958-59, it's called Paths of Glory. And to me, it's one of the really fine movies on any war, and maybe any movie. So that's good. And then the early the movie Gallipoli, which features Mel Gibson in one of his earliest starring roles, is really, really a fine movie. You know, it would be close to my top 10 movie list. So those are both about, you know, the battlefront to some extent and the effects of the battlefront and all that. What do you have in mind? If you got some in mind, maybe I've seen them, maybe I haven't, put them down there. Maybe I'm just blocking those and I actually have some. then Malcolm says, to what extent did the establishment of Poland as a homeland set a precedent for Israel later? Well, I I'm sure somebody discussed it because Poland had an enormous number of its population, enormous percentage of its population was Jewish. And of course, a lot of those went to Israel. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I don't know specifically about this discussion. I'm sure they did talk about it. The difference would be that, of course, that the period where Poland had been submerged was just from the year 1795. Whereas even if you accept that kind of normative standard mainstream history of Israel, then that went back to, you know, a considerably longer period. So, I don't know. That's a good question. But that too was in the same way, it was the issue was used during the war. I mean, the whole Balfour Declaration was about getting the help of Jews worldwide, especially Zionists worldwide, to basically contribute to the war effort, to urge their countries on in the war against the other side, etc. When in fact, of course, many Jews were very much, many well-to-do Jews were very much conflicted, because Jews above all, knowing what the Russians had done in their pogroms against the Jews and their persecution of Jews in the last years of the Russian Empire, many of the crucial figures in world Jewry and well-to-do people and would have preferred the central power, since Russia was only on the other side. So that's an interesting part of that. But it's a good question. I mean, it's the reformation of those countries after they had disappeared. Malcolm rephrased his question. After America entered the war, do you think that Germany could have fought defensively to an armistice without losing territory, having to change government, etc.? After America, no, I don't think so, Malcolm. I think it was pretty clear. Now, it's, Ludendorff twice in the summer, late summer of 1918, I kind of had nervous breakdowns, and twice he cabled Berlin, sent telegrams to the government saying, we're totes. It's also true that his stepson had been killed that summer, and he took off about, he did some weird, he was a man who had every pressure in the world on him. So he may not have been looking at this precisely, but it is certainly true that the German general staff on the whole, and they were all coolest cucumbers, his general staff, they all thought that too. They thought that Germany was defeated, that the government needed to do something. And that's kind of an irony, since Ludendorff had been almost single-handedly in charge of, along with Hindenburg, the military dictator over the government. So at the end of it, Ludendorff said, well, they got themselves into this trouble. They stabbed us in the back. Let them get us out of it. But in actuality, it was the opposite way. The government should have negotiated when they were riding high, before the Americans ever came in. They should have said, okay, look, guys, we're holding a big chunk of France, nearly all of Belgium, Luxembourg, and to tell you the truth, we could take other things if we wanted, so let's negotiate. But in fact, they didn't. They pressed on for total victory and all that stuff. And so it was really this business about being stabbed in the back. Germany got stabbed in the back, all right, but it was by Ludendorff and Hindenburg. That's my opinion. So, but I don't think by the summer of 1918, I mean, listen, we were about, the United States was about to form the Fourth Army. So we're talking about 400,000 American troops, fresh, well-fed, huge, big, beefy guys. You know, they weren't your scrawny, working class, malnourished Northern Europeans. These were big, strong soldiers on the front, and in huge numbers, with the best of equipment, all new, more barbed wire than you could ever even imagine in your life. And then they just move on. So I don't think the Germans, I think it was all up. I mean, whether Ludendorff was a little crazy or not, they did have to do something, whether it was in October or November or in August or whatever, it was over for the Germans. Okay, other questions? Let me see. See, there's this whole big discussion up here at the top, and I can't. Checking all these out. All Quiet on the Western Front, Paths of Glory. Yeah, I like All Quiet on the Western Front, and I think it's a really good picture of the war for sure. But I like these others better. So, let's see. What do we got? Hey, we're up to 20 participants. That's good. Now let's see. Somebody's got a comment here. Okay. So Malcolm writes, I don't want to spend all that time reading all that, Malcolm, but let's see. If I wrote it, I guess I should know it anyway. So to the question, do you have any reading you recommend showing that the Allies pursued negotiations of armistice to reduce, eliminate growth of American influence, or reduce, eliminate the number of troops? No. They wanted a total, with the Americans on their side, they wanted a total victory. They wanted to hammer the Germans as much as they could. Get them as low as they could so that they could bring them to Versailles and do what they did to them. That's what they wanted. So I don't think there's any, after the Americans were in, the negotiations for the, as far as the British and French were concerned, were off the table completely. They were not interested in that. They waited until the Germans contacted them, and then they said, look, we're only going to talk about your surrender. We're not going to talk about anything else. And the Germans said, okay, well, let's go on that basis. So that's what I think about that. Okay, let me see if there are other questions up here. Anybody got anything else? Let's see. And then, oh, Malcolm, this is new. Could you discuss the forming of the executive budget under Taft and how it came to be? You know, I don't really know anything about that, Malcolm. So I'm sorry, I just don't know. So I can't discuss it. The answer is no, I'm sorry, I can't. Let's see. Okay. Well, does this mean, that we're at an end? I guess it does. And it's been a good hour and a half and a little bit more. Does anybody have anything else before we call it a night? Oh, I saw a couple of questions up here. Very good. Let's go up there. It's harder to see. In fact, I'm going to try to broaden that chat. Rodney, there's a lot of good books on British propaganda. Look up Trevor Wilson. Look up, let's see, who can I think of right offhand? There's a small library on that. So yeah, those are easy to find. And some Austrian types have written about that too. There's a little bit about that in my book. Not a whole lot, but there's some references in there. You can get a hold of the whole copy of the Western Front. let's see. Brad says, how have you been processing our Middle Eastern war? Do you think there has been a planned strategy of selling Americans on war successes, or is it just a nationalistic bent to see successes where there are so many failures? I think all countries have to sell the war, but our country more than than others, I would say, because these are so far-fetched in many ways in terms of our interest. And in each of these serial wars, we've ended up worse off at the afterwards than we were at the beginning. So yeah, I think it's both. I mean, we're going to sell our, and every administration is going to sell its war policy. So yeah, I think that's a little bit of both, actually. Let's see. Ralph Franco says the Belgian atrocity lies of World War I made people assume the Holocaust accounts were lies as well. Sort of like the boy who cried wolf. Yes, that's absolutely right. Because the Bryce report's online. It's all readable, and it's like a kind of old pornography from the 19th century, gentleman's pornography, where there's all these horrible, cruel puns, like the Marquis de Sade, but a little bit more realistic and refined or something. It's really sadistic, and it's all these children having their hands cut off and nuns having body parts cut off and all this kind of stuff. And the fact of the matter is that Belgium in the post-war period just didn't have all that many children without hands. I mean, we know today in places where they really do cut hands off that there are a lot of people who are the victims of that who grow up and we see them. We know that today. But in Belgium, that just didn't happen. And there's it's not just the Bryce report. Ralph and I have discussed this many times. I mean, there was a kind of a soap factory. Allies, the Germans making soap of the bodies they find on the battlefield. And so that too led to a skeptic, because after the war, everybody realized most of those things were almost all in the lie. Now, remember, the Germans did shoot a bunch of civilians, 6,000 civilians in Belgium. That's bad. I mean, just shot them. So anybody who would resist or seem to, make an old man take a blunderbuss and shoot at him out of the window, then they'd haul him out and shoot him and then do reprisal shootings to boot. So the Germans were nasty. They had a policy they called Schrecklichkeit. That's horrible, awfulness. But so did other countries. Russians behaved exactly the same way. The Italians behaved in similar ways. So anyway, there's all that. But yeah, I think that's certainly the case. Ralph is, I agree perfectly on that. Let's see, what else do we have here? Malcolm says, can you speak of how philanthropies affected entry into World War I and the writing of history after? I'm sorry, Malcolm, I don't know quite what that means. Maybe you can rephrase that. Or maybe if everybody's about done in, we can put that in the forum and talk about it. Brett, I'm going to give the instructions along with the thing. It's not very long. It's more the meat of the matter than not. But I'll give a number of words or something when I send this in. And I'll send it in tomorrow. And I will, I promise. He's laughing into his coffee now. But anyway, I'll give you all that stuff tomorrow. So I think we're done. Let's just say we're done for tonight. If you have other questions, you want to put them on the forum, I'll be poring over that. I'll be glad to talk to you over that way. Thank you very much, Malcolm. Thanks, Brad. Thanks. Thanks to everybody. I enjoyed it very much, and it's going to be even more fun next week. We'll talk about the peace conference. Huge fun. So I will see you then. Bye-bye. Good night.